Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting is Caroline White. Hey Caroline.
Hello Stu. Well, since it's absolutely freezing here in London, it's making me think about the Dolomites and our next Boat International event.
Seamless link.
Thank you.
That's right. Some housekeeping. The Superyacht Design Festival is just a few short weeks away. If you haven't booked your ticket yet, it's not too late. Come and join us in Cortina from 8th to the 10th of February for a few days of amazing speakers, fabulous social events, a little skiing, if that takes your fancy, and the best networking outside of Davos.
Well, yeah, I'm looking forward very much to a presentation that I'm helping to organise with Frypack, who are presenting a very exciting project that I'm actually not sure how much I can say about it. I don't want to nix the whole thing by revealing too much, but it's a very, very, very cool fossil-free project. And if you want to hear more about it, then you must come to the Superyacht Design Festival.
Yeah, I know a bit about this too. It is a truly landmark, groundbreaking, benchmark moving project.
All the superlatives.
All those superlatives. It is very, very exciting. So, I mean, I'm fingers crossed they can really spill the beans at the Design Festival. I trust your journalistic skills to wheedle all the details out of them.
Well, I'm just relying on them because they're brilliant and know everything about the project. So I don't want any blowback, thanks. But no, I'm sure it'll be very good. Very good.
Yeah, I'm sure too. And then in March, I just wanted to flag our Between the Bays event, which is happening from 9th to 12th that month. It's a spectacular superyacht rendezvous running over 4 days between the beautiful Belmond properties on the islands of Anguilla and St. Martin. So if you'd like to join us there with your yacht, head to our website now and take a look at the details. It's a big new event on the Caribbean calendar, and we'd love to see you there. It's going to be a lot of fun. I think that then after that, it goes straight to St. Bart's and then straight to the Palm Beach Boat Show. So March is always tricky. It's just too much going on in March.
It's a tough life. It's a tough life, Stu. Bouncing around between the Caribbean and beautiful European destinations. Well, I'm here in the office taking care of... No, I'm joking. It's also in the office quite a lot.
No, well, not in March. So one thing we haven't really mentioned on the podcast, well, we've only done one this year, so we didn't mention it last week, and we haven't mentioned it in the magazine yet either, or online, and that is the simple fact that it is Boat International's 40th birthday this year. Our first issue, the first issue ever of Boat International, was published in 1983. Do we know what month?
So it doesn't actually have a month. It's a summer-autumn 1983 issue, so I'm guessing at this point it wasn't a monthly magazine.
Yeah, interesting. There aren't that many. They're not abundant, are they? Issue ones of Boat International. I think there's one or two in the office.
There's one, and I'm holding it in my hand right now. And if I lose it, I think some people are going to kill me. I had to go down to the basement, into the back of the basement, behind some boxes, in the back of a cupboard. I had to prise it out. I hurt my finger. And I've got the issue. I don't think there is another one that we have anyway. I'd be interested to know if someone else does actually.
Occasionally you see them on eBay and things like that.
Yeah.
But it was interesting because I agonize over my editor's letter every month, and it takes me, like, everyone teases me because it takes me a day to write about 150 words. But it was interesting, the kind of like the mission statement of Boat International, that very first issue back in 1983. I thought I'd just read the very first editor's letter. It says, Boat International is a new magazine aimed to delight all who love boats and boating. Our horizons are wide, sail and power to craft racing and cruising in Britain and around the world. Our writers and photographers are simply the best. Nothing's changed, eh?
No, better than the best.
And our intent is to package their sparkling words. There you go, sparkling words.
Thank you.
And glowing pictures in the finest boating magazine on the bookstalls. No, we don't really say bookstalls anymore, do we?
No.
The first number is understandably focused sharply on the America's Cup. In future issues, we shall voyage more widely, covering major competitions under sail and power, but also providing features on favorite cruising grounds and harbors, boating fashion and gear, the fascinating personalities of the sport, and the famous boat builders. Our ambition is simple: but exacting to produce a magazine which everyone who likes any form of boating will want not merely to read, but to keep and treasure.
Oh,
that's nice, isn't it?
It is very nice.
I think we've kept to that.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree. I mean, I would say, looking, I've gone through this issue in kind of forensic detail, and it is much more focused on sailing yachts than our current magazine perhaps is. But that's as that editor's letter suggests, largely because the America's Cup is the focus of it. So it has, there's a 26 page feature on the history of the America's Cup in here with a lot, yeah, with a lot of black and white profile shots of sailing yachts, which is great. And then there's some really interesting stuff on the different challenger teams for that particular America's Cup, the 1983 America's Cup. So Australia, Canada, France, Italy, and the UK, who were challenging New York. So what's quite interesting, this was the first successful challenge to the New York Yacht Club's 132-year defense of the cup. So this is just the build-up, but actually the cup that resulted was one of the most interesting in history.
Yeah, it's all about the winged keel. This gives me a great opportunity to flag a brilliant documentary I saw on Netflix recently. I've mentioned the podcast before, and I'm desperately looking at my phone now for Netflix because I cannot remember the name of it. It's called...
Is it Below Deck, Stu?
It's definitely not Below Deck. There we go. Untold, the Race of the Century.
Oh.
So, yeah, if you only have a passing interest in the America's Cup, go have a look at that Netflix documentary. I loved it. It was so, so good. A colleague of mine here at the company mentioned it to me and loved it. It's fantastic. Loads of great detail.
Brilliant.
Go in Australia too for the first time in the America's Cup history. Took it home.
Oh, fantastic.
And Bob Hawke, the Prime Minister, told everyone to go and get drunk and have a good party down in Australia after we won that.
Bob Hawke, the most Australian man who has ever lived.
Could down a pint in 3 seconds or something.
Well, actually, on that note, there was a travel feature in this first issue, and it's just embarrassingly full of sort of cultural slurs, some of them aimed at Australians, some at French, some at Italian people. The only people who don't get it are the Brits. So it's a very 1983 travel feature.
Pre-woke.
Very, very pre-woke.
Okay, interesting. I leave it. Can you leave it out? Don't relegate it back to the basement. I want to, to have a read of that.
That'd be
fascinating archive material. Yeah, so that's Boat International. Happy birthday, Boat International.
Happy birthday.
We haven't quite figured out how we're going to celebrate it yet. Maybe we'll have a big cake in Monaco or something. I don't know.
Yeah, good idea.
So one thing, of course, the writers of all that sparkling copy back in 1983 could never have imagined is something that is a big feature in the March issue of Boat International. I want to talk about it because I've gone down a bit of a rabbit hole with Starlink and low Earth orbit satellite constellations, because everyone's talking about it. In Fort Lauderdale, I was amazed by how many owners were talking about Starlink and how easy they say it was. I mean, Starlink Maritime, there's two kind of versions, basically. I think there's even three. There's the domestic one, so for your home. There's the RV version, which you stick on the top of your recreational vehicle. And there's the maritime version. So the maritime version, I think, hasn't been out terribly long. But what some captains and crew did was buy the RV version and stick that on their yachts, which worked fine, as I understand it, until very recently. I think Starlink have taken a slightly dim view of people buying an RV version of their system and sticking it on their boat. So I think it's geo-fenced now. So I saw that somewhere.
Can we take it back to base? Because I'm embarrassed to say I've heard a lot of chat, but I'm really not clear on how it works. So can you break it down like I'm a small child?
Yes, happy to. Although I don't know if I can. I'm so far down the rabbit hole. I'm not sure that I can't find my way out again. So basically, so the concept of low Earth orbit communications and internet satellites isn't new. There was the first wave. There was an attempt in the 90s to build LEO constellations, but none of them really worked, or if they didn't work, they were scaled back dramatically. So this is really the second wave, and Starlink got there first. So they've stuck something like over 3,000 of these LEO satellites into orbit, and they're going to stick up to 12,000 to create this truly global kind of mesh that sits around the globe that will offer broadband, very fast broadband speed internet anywhere in the world. And the whole point of the good thing about LEO satellites is they're so close to the planet's surface that the signal, the latency, the time it takes for the satellite to talk to the ground is very, very small. So you get, and you can get much faster internet. Traditionally, boats sailing around the world have been picking up internet or connectivity from medium Earth orbit or geostationary orbit satellites, which orbit the Earth at much farther distances, 20,000 kilometers and about 36,000 kilometers. So if you imagine, someone explained to me like this. So imagine like a torch, right? You have a basketball and a torch. You move the torch in close to the basketball, you have a much more focused, brighter beam, but on a much smaller part of the ball. You pull the torch out and the beam covers more of the ball, but it's dimmer, which is basically how LEO and GEO satellites work.
Okay.
So Starlink isn't global yet. So I've spoken to some owners who have crossed the Atlantic recently with Starlink systems, and they lost it off the Azores and only picked it up as they approached the Caribbean. Right. But I'm told by Starlink insiders that they reckon they'll have global coverage by March this year.
So where is it really good?
Well, at the moment, it's really good in the Med, coastal areas of North America and the rest of Europe, bit of Australia, bit of South America. But if you look on their website, there are these big bands where it's just nothing at the moment.
Okay.
Maybe because they haven't switched the satellites on. I'm not too sure. But the Starlink, they can launch, because obviously Starlink's a SpaceX offshoot. They own the whole thing. So Musk sends up these rockets with 64 satellites at a time in them.
Wow.
So you might have seen pictures in the news of this kind of duck's trail of satellites crossing the night sky. That's all the Starlink array kind of, I guess, getting into position.
Amazing. Okay.
But it's important to say that Starlink aren't the only players. So there's another company called OneWeb, which is putting an LEO array into orbit with much fewer satellites, around 650. So they're the only competition currently, and they're a bit more open. So at the moment, Starlink receivers can only pick up the Starlink constellation. The OneWeb constellation can be picked up by third-party technology.
That's interesting.
And Amazon are getting in the game as well. So they've got something called Project Kuiper, I'm not quite sure. And they're putting their first prototype satellites into orbit this year.
So the whole sky is just going to be packed with low Earth orbit satellites.
Well, yeah, and astronomers, as you'd expect,
pretty
pissed off about it, because you know there's obviously two sides, and some people say, well, you know, they're actually not that visible, and they're not going to ruin the night sky and all this kind of stuff. But I mean, I read something that they're going to put. So there's going to be, I think it's about 5,000. I think that's right. There's roughly 5,000 satellites in orbit right now. If all the LEO constellations, all the proposed LEO constellations go into orbit, they all work and they're all launched, and they're all in orbit, that number will increase 40 times.
Wow. Okay.
Crazy.
Yeah, absolutely crazy.
But it's really fascinating. But the people that have adopted it love it. So the motor yacht Loon, a big Newcastle Marine built boat. So they were one of the first people to get a Starlink maritime system, and they absolutely love it. They love it. The speeds they get are fantastic. They have said, however, that as more boats adopt it, especially if they're in an anchorage next to a cruise ship or near a cruise ship, they do, the service does slow, because obviously there's only limited bandwidth. And if you've got tons of users plugging into a particular satellite, then your signal is strangled a bit. But they travel at enormous speeds. So it's so all these satellites are traveling at tens of thousands of kilometers an hour. Sorry, just
how far down this rabbit hole are we going to go with you?
stop me! Stop me! As Caroline started yawning, so I'll stop in a second. So, but it's so complex. The reason the first attempt failed is because the engineering and the technical capability, or the technical competence, has to be so high. So all these satellites, they're traveling so fast, and so many of them, you might only see a particular satellite for 10 minutes, and you have to make a constant internet connection. So if your satellite receivers, your Starlink dish is sitting there, or your Starlink antenna is sitting there, you see one satellite for 10 minutes. That's got to hand over to the next one, and next one, and next one, and next one, completely seamlessly. So over the course of a movie, you might be handed over to, 15, 20 satellites or something. So it's enormously complex.
Right. And lots of room for error then, presumably.
Yeah. So there's the early adopters are raving. There's a few notes of caution. Some of the older, wiser heads in the business are saying, well, let's not get too excited yet. It could all, it hasn't quite lived up to its billing just yet. But early reports are very favorable. But it's not the only game in town. So the LEO market is just going to explode for global communications over the next few years.
So interesting. Thank you. That was genuine. That was genuine.
That did not sound sincere at all.
Sorry, it was sincere.
So I've been down a Starlink rabbit hole. You've been down a tender rabbit hole.
I have. So many tenders. So we're running in the March issue of Boat International, I think the biggest tender special we've ever done. We've got some very cool stuff in there. We've got boat tests on the Leca 44, the Pardo GT52, and the Invictus TT460. The Invictus I'm a particular fan of. I think she's a real beauty. We also have a huge news section packed with the latest tough tenders, custom beauties, electric tenders, and that's a trend that's not going away. And we even have a section on hydrogen tenders. We actually have a piece there by Ben Ainslie about about hydrogen chase boats that they'll be using in the next America's Cup. So whatever you want from a tender, we've got you covered with that special in the March issue.
Yeah, we've really gone to town with the tenders, haven't we?
Yeah.
So, well, that first issue of Boat International, 26 pages on the America's Cup.
Yes.
We haven't done quite 26 pages, but there's a lot.
Yeah.
There's a lot of tender news.
We do also have a column by Ben Ainslie in the March issue about the America's Cup. So, there's an echo of our 40-year-old initial magazine there.
Double Ben. We get a double dose of Ben.
Double dose
in the
of
March
Ben.
Issue.
Exactly.
It's interesting, the hydrogen tender stuff. That was a requirement of this America's Cup protocol, as I understand it. So that's it's going to be interesting to see how that all comes together.
Yeah.
But I mean, the tender market's never been more exciting. Electric tenders, foiling tenders, landing craft.
Yeah. Occasionally, Stu gets an obsession. Sometimes catamarans is famously one. It looks like tenders might be the next one.
Catamaran tenders.
There are catamarans.
We've got a good catamaran news story a bit later. But I wanted to flag another story that has got on the website, because it's quite big news in the yachting world. And that was, of course, an accident report has been published about the collision between Utopia 4, the 63-meter Rossi Navi, and the 49-meter tanker Tropic Breeze. You might remember this happened back in 2021.
Yes, I've heard a bit about this. What actually happened?
Well, they hit each other, basically, at about 10 p.m. at night. Rossi, Utopia 4 was going 20 knots. The tanker was going 5 knots. And Utopia 4 slammed into the back of the tanker, ripped a hole in it, and it sank in about 2,000 meters of water. Everyone was rescued. Everyone was fine. There were some minor injuries on Utopia. Eventually the crew abandoned ship on the tanker. They were picked up by the Fed ship Amara.
Wow. I mean, obviously two massive vessels. How does it happen, assuming that visibility was okay? How can they hit each other?
The visibility was okay. We didn't really know. We didn't know that the finer details, the granular details, but we do now because of this report by the National Transportation Safety Board. It's just been published and it contains some fairly shocking details. The biggest one, I suppose, is that neither captain was in the wheelhouse at the time of the collision. So Utopia 4's captain was with the charter guests and left the bosun in the bridge. But according to the report, the bosun was not certified as mate or captain and therefore was not allowed by regulations to perform watchkeeping duties by himself. Tropic Breeze's captain, meanwhile, had left the bridge to use the facilities, but I guess maybe he thought they were only traveling at 5 knots, so perhaps he, you know, considered the risk minimal. The report determined that given the relative speed of both vessels, it was likely that none of the watchstanders had looked at the radar in the 12 minutes before the collision or completed a visual assessment of the surroundings.
So that means looking out of the window?
Yes. I think the bosun and the bridge of Utopia 4 was distracted at the time.
Okay.
So there's some CCTV footage that was published, or studied rather, by the investigators. And they saw, you know, the interior of Utopia 4 at the moment of the collision. Equipment and several of the yacht's crew were thrown to the deck or into bulkheads. 3 crew sustained minor injuries. And Utopia 4's captain was in the main dining room at the time, presumably just chatting to the guests, and was thrown into the forward bulkhead and door frame. So it should be noted, of course, it's not unusual for the captain of a charter yacht like that to leave the bridge and go and talk to the guests, or, you know, ask how your dinner was, or, you know, have a bit of chat about the program for the next day and all that kind of stuff. But obviously you've got to leave a competent and capable and
certified
crew member in the bridge to cover for you. So Utopia 4 approached Tropic Breeze from directly astern. The yacht, so Utopia 4, was required by coal regs to give way to the tanker, but because watchstanders on both boats failed to maintain a proper lookout, both were unable to identify the risk of collision and respond suitably. So the report said, although the Utopia 4 bore responsibility as the overtaking vessel to maneuver away from the tanker vessel, once the yacht's intentions were unclear and a close quarter situation had developed, the tank vessel should have taken action. But didn't, because you didn't see it. So it's pretty shocking. Because, you know, especially because the tanker sank. Thank God everyone was okay, because that would have, you know, what's already a pretty nasty and shocking situation would have been tragic had someone lost their lives.
Absolutely. So. I mean, we spend most of our time talking about incredible design and beautiful destinations and that sort of thing. So it's quite easy to forget how dangerous being on a boat can be if you take your eyes off the ball for even a minute, or 12 minutes in this case.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, the whole thing's fascinating, and we've got a link to the full report in the story. So, like, as ever, we'll put a link in the description. So if you're interested in that, just head to the Boat International website and read Holly Overton's story. And at the very bottom, just click the link, and then you can go down your own rabbit hole with with that safety report. But, you know, I hope everyone pays attention to its findings, because, fewer of those, the better, please. But... I know you're going to have a go at me for this podcast going down a slightly negative route. But I want to talk about fires.
Oh, bloody hell. People are going to stop buying the magazine.
So, you'd have to be blind or asleep not to have noticed that over the last couple of years there's been a slightly more regular occurrence of boat fires, basically. Boats just seem to catch. There was a run, I think it was in 2021 or even last year. It just seemed like about a six-month period where almost every other week there was another story about a boat catching fire.
Yep.
So we ran this, we ran a story in a magazine. It's now online. Sam Fortescue did a brilliant investigation into the background of it all. And one of the first things you have to say that he says in the story, that it's really hard to determine ultimately what's causing some of these fires, because, of course, the evidence is so often at the bottom of the ocean or has gone up in smoke. So it's a bit of guesswork, or educated guesswork, involved. But he kicks off the story with the details of the burning of the 35-meter Tanzer yacht Siempre in September 2021. Everyone got out safe, again, thank God. But the boat was obviously a total loss. I mean, the pictures are awful. The investigators later reported that they thought the source of the fire was likely to have been a faulty lithium-ion battery for the owner's water scooter, or a fault in its power socket. Crew were aware of the problem with both items, having previously repaired scorching inside the socket. and they were awaiting instructions on disposing of the faulty battery, keeping it in a locker for safety.
I mean, so you mentioned there's been a kind of spate of these stories. I mean, it feels like there have been a lot that have, I mean, have there actually been a lot more recently?
Well, the insurers have something to say about that. So Allianz found that 18% of marine claims from 2017 to 2021 came down to fire, resulting in losses of 1.65 billion euros. And there was another massive story, not a super yacht, obviously, but the 200-meter-long car carrier Felicity Ace in March 22 caught fire. It had hundreds of electric vehicles on board. No one knows how the fire started, or at least I haven't heard how the fire started, but it's thought the lithium batteries in the cars quickly aggravated the blaze. I mean, the issue, we're told, isn't the battery installations, the fixed battery installations on boats, because they obviously have to meet class approval. The problem, as we understand it, is these portable batteries using the growing, ever-expanding fleet of, you know, kind of the must-have superyacht toys. And there's clear frustration from people who want to see some change in the industry. Herb Magny, Captain Herb Magny, is one. So he says for every fire, there's hundreds of near misses, which is a scary thing to think about, isn't it? He says, I have seen several, been involved in a few, and know firsthand from watching blazing batteries getting thrown overboard about many more.
Wow. So, I mean, what kind of changes could be made? Presumably people aren't buying toys knowing that they're unsafe.
No. Well, you just assume, don't you? I mean, you buy a high-quality yacht toy, you just assume that it's going to be safe. But everyone should be taking sensible steps, and I'll detail a few in a minute. But one of the big problems we have is confidentiality. No one talks to each other about the accidents, really. So it's very hard to build a data set. Steve Monk from Degamma Maritime, a training organization who's spoken previously at the Explore Yacht Summit, he's, you know, pretty frustrated with the situation. So he said, battles against confidentiality agreements, release of accident reports, and indeed even the notification of accidents, regardless of their cause, are still areas where we need to get more clarity. Try kicking those doors open and we may get somewhere rather than just setting fire to yachts or harming crew trying to put out preventable fires with equipment they're not safe to operate.
Wow.
Yeah, so he doesn't pull his punches, no. Steve. He really takes this incredibly seriously, and he kind of sighs with frustration. And a lot of the confidentiality and secret keeping in a superyacht business, I mean, it's a confidential kind of industry anyway, but you know, when it comes to best practice around fire safety, I mean, it's crazy that we're not sharing more information. So you can buy stuff, you can buy kit that will pick up potential, there are gas analyzers and things like that, and heat sensors and all this kind of stuff you can install to detect if there's going to be a problem. But the insurer Beasley has some pretty clear-cut rules on safe lithium battery storage. They say, don't charge while the yacht is unattended or between sunset and sunrise. Only charge batteries on deck. Only use the original manufacturer's supplied charger. Charge batteries only ever on a heat-proof mat. Follow the manufacturer's recommendations, obviously. An operational fire extinguisher suitable for lithium-ion batteries should be on board and accessible by crew members in the event of a fire. And when batteries are not being charged or in use, store them in a fireproof box. So you can buy these kind of, you know, safes, basically, fireproof safes, where you can just chuck these batteries in. And even if they explode, I think you'll be fine.
Wow, some good points.
Yeah. So, I mean, training's really key. And Magny makes that point as well. He says in the story, the average deckhand gets more product and training time provided to them on how to polish stainless steel in the course of a month than they do for dealing with a lithium polymer battery fire in a year or more. So it's a must read, really, for owners and crew alike. A lot of these fires are completely avoidable if these really sensible steps are taken.
Can we talk about some good news, please, Stu?
Yeah, of course. Why don't you kick us off?
So the bare hull of FedShip's 82.9-meter in-build Project 712 has been spotted as it was moved from the construction shed at the yard's Papendrecht facilities. The steel and aluminium yacht will now be transported to FedShip's Alsmeer site for outfitting. Little is known about the sub 2000 GT yacht, but initial images indicate a plumb bow, unfolding terraces in the beach club, and a forward-loading tender garage. Delivery is due in 2024. The yacht's naval architecture comes from De Voogt, while the interiors are understood to be by Sinnoh Yacht Architecture and Design.
Thanks, Caroline. Story number two, right up my street, this one. The two hulls of the very first Wider Cat 92 catamaran have been spotted en route to Wider's Farno shipyard as the model starts to take shape ahead of its anticipated launch this summer. The 28-meter catamaran is the first multi-hull offering from the Wider yachts. It has been designed in collaboration with Luca Dini. He's a very busy man at the moment. Hull number one is the first of five Wider Cat 92s hull currently sold. And they were less than a year after the model was presented. The Wider Cat will be powered by a hybrid propulsion system that works in tandem with solar panels to power both the propulsion system and hotel load. The yacht can run in full electric mode for totally silent and vibration-free cruising, while any unused power is sent to recharge the battery packs. The first hull will be making its debut at this year's Cannes Yachting Festival. I will be there. I will be checking that out eagerly. Two other hulls will be delivered to the US thanks to Wider's partnership with Marine Max. And last but not least, if Anchorman, the legend of Ron Burgundy, taught us anything, it's that you always end the news with a lovely, heartwarming story about an animal. Caroline.
Well, Northrop & Johnson has officially completed the donation process of the 25.3-meter Burger yacht Serene. So the recipient of the yacht was the National Save the Sea Turtle Foundation based in Fort Lauderdale. So since 1987, the foundation has worked to provide educational programming, support sea turtle research globally, and promote public awareness of Florida's marine ecosystems. The beautifully maintained vessel has received meticulous care over the years, according to Northrop & Johnson. Her extensive refit in 2021 included $400,000 in refurbishments, according to her listing broker. The National Save the Sea Turtle Foundation runs a boat donation service in their work to support a national effort in protecting the United States' marine environment and endangered sea turtles.
Isn't that nice?
It's lovely.
Save the turtles. So if you've got a boat going spare, you don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
Charlotte actually wrote a feature, I think it was last year, about boat donation, how you donate your boat if you wanted to do that. Mm. And there's a few organizations out there. And I have just discovered that National Save the Sea Turtle Foundation is another one.
Fantastic.
So data, let's wind it up with some data. So as ever, our data story this month is brought to you by Boat Pro, our award-winning market intelligence service. Check it out today. So obviously Boat Pro's central functions is that you can track super yachts around the world. We have a great AIS functionality. So Gabrielle Lazaridis put together this story for us. So she tracked the 10 most active super yachts in 2022 across the entire year. Which boat traveled the furthest, did the most stuff? So let's go from 1 to 5 and then we'll do a whip through 5 to 10. So number one, leading the pack is DSSV Pressure Drop. She's always up there. So she is a 68.3-meter research vessel. So she traveled 37,665 nautical miles. She spent most of it, well, all of it in the Pacific, really. She went to Japan, the mid-Pacific, Hawaii, down to South America, Chile, Mexico. Massive trip.
So was this while she was in possession of Victor Vescovo still?
Yes, but he sold her.
Right.
Not too long ago. So I think so, yes.
Okay. Well, it'll be interesting to see if she keeps up this kind of travel in her new ownership.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the cooler things she did in 2022, the crew uncovered a sunken US Navy destroyer named Sammy B.
Wow.
The deepest shipwreck ever to be surveyed. Two on the list is Legend, 77.4-meter Legend. She traveled 30,216 nautical miles. So she basically went from one side of the planet to the other. I'm not joking. You look at the map, she went from the Arctic to the Antarctic. She traveled so far, she could have circled the globe twice at the equator. She crossed the Atlantic twice, moving from the Antarctic to Svalbard and then back again in 2 6-month voyages with stop-offs in the Med and Norway along the way. In third place is 32-meter Bunker Populaire 11.
Beautiful pronunciation.
Did you like that? I didn't make you do the French.
No. Thanks. It's letting me off the hook.
Bonjour. So this trimaran traveled 27,102 nautical miles. Mm. She spent basically most of that time, back and forth across the Atlantic between Guadeloupe and the coast of Europe. You can see, long tacks in her track. It's really, really interesting. In fourth place is the monstrous 98.4-meter Aviva. She traveled 26,196 nautical miles in 2022.
The owner of Aviva is a very well-known British football club owner. And Aviva has on board this incredible multi-story paddle tennis court in the centre of the boat. So before he owned Aviva, he used to travel around a lot on his previous yacht, but he wanted to play paddle tennis every day. So the crew of his yacht had to carry with them at all times this sort of paddle tennis court, portable paddle tennis court that they would erect in various locations. And obviously you can't do that everywhere. So he was quite restricted because he needed to play paddle tennis every day. Now that he's got Aviva, he can just go anywhere he wants, which is why I imagine the distance is so absolutely crazy, because he just lives on board. He's in his 80s, just travels around playing paddle tennis every day.
You live forever playing paddle tennis every day.
Yeah.
Why not? In fifth place is Andromeda, formerly Ulysses, 107.4-meter motor yacht, one of my favorites, just because she's tough as nails. So she traveled 26,044 nautical miles. She racked up the miles traveling from northern Australia through the Malacca Strait and across the Indian Ocean to the Seychelles. She doubled back and spent the latter half of 2022 traveling eastward across the Pacific for a Christmas in the Bahamas. So mostly Indian Ocean, Southeast Asia, bit of Australia, bit of Papua New Guinea, then back across the Pacific, back up into the Caribbean.
Delightful.
Yeah. Great trip. Great trip. And then just from 5 to 10, so in sixth place is Hansa Explorer, seventh place is Voyager, eighth place is Nomad, the Amels. I mean, great to, she's done a lot actually as well. Lots of time in the Atlantic, Med, Mexico, Central America. V6 is in ninth place. So V6 won a Voyagers Award a couple of years ago at the World Superyacht Awards. So she, a lot of time in the Caribbean, Mexico, up the west coast of the States, up to Alaska, Canada. It's a beautiful country up there. You've done that trip, haven't you? I've never done that. I'd still want to do that.
I've never done Alaska. I've done the west coast of Canada. That was pretty spectacular.
Right. And last but not least is Hodor in 10th place, the support ship to Lonian. She spent pretty much all of 22 in the Pacific on the west coast of the US. So there you go. Some incredibly well-traveled super yachts. But congratulations to Pressure Drop for being number one. And that brings us to a close. Thank you, Caroline.
You're welcome.
So now you don't need to hear about Starlink for another few days, so I'll spare you.
Thank you.
No worries. Thank you for tuning in, everybody. This has been, as ever, mixed and produced by Grace Nielsen and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe. And we'll see you next time. Have a great week.